Valiantos.
Yes. Hi. How are you doing?
Very good, sir. Very good. I have spent some very, very sober time with your book, Poison Spring. And I am far from naive, but it is a real eye opener, and so thorough, so documented, sir. It is a real honor to be able to talk to you about so significant an issue. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome Mr. E.G. Valiantos, mm-hmm. author of Poison Spring and many other books, who has been so generous with his life and so committed to the truth that he has become what I'm going to call, probably not the only one, an EPA whistleblower. Thank you, sir, for the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, let me ask you a few questions, then I'd really like you to tell your story.
Okay.
One of the things that I've learned from your discussions is that while many of us have had a well-deserved skepticism of many of our government's activities, because even those of us among the more informed, environmentally attentive people have sort of hoped. I'm going to say it's a hope. We sort of hope that somebody had our back. We sort of hope that the best of science, the best people who are informed on issues of the environment, of industrial chemistry, of certainly environmental regulation, had our backs and were looking out for us to some extent anyway. And even though many of us have turned to, if you will, the organic foods and the organic oriented diets, we sort of hope that in our homes, in our workplaces, in our public parks, in our forests, we could count on some modicum of safety. And it looks, sir, from what you're saying and what we learned at that pesticide conference, that that's not the case at all. That if anything, the EPA has been looking out for agribusiness and big chemistry. Is that a fair characterization, sir?
Yeah, you said it very well. Yes, indeed. It's a misfortune. I mean, in the 20th century, we had this explosive growth of the chemical industry and industrialization version of agriculture, and everything else became industrial. And these companies learned early on that they could cut corners, and they began to use their political connections, and the corruption process got into high gear, and the result has been exactly what you just described.
Let's go back, and let's go back to the very beginning. I noticed in your book something that I was very in a book with so many disastrous stories, a positive story that even before Rachel Carson, there were people who were making notes on the effects of agricultural chemistry. You mentioned a Dr. Morton Biskin
from
Westport. Could you start with that? Talk a little bit about his work, and then I'm going to ask you to talk about your early life and what got you to chemistry. So, could you talk about Dr. Westport and those other early pioneers who were taking notice of the effects of pesticides and herbicides?
Yes, they were trained in ecological or entomological science, and they were very sensitive to wildlife, and they could notice the effects of this spraying. And they began to warn us by writing scholarly articles or in newspapers, and they could see the future. I mean, they could see the effects on wildlife, and they could figure out that if this trend continues, we're going to have what they describe in many ways disasters, effects in the ecosystems and biological life. And in general, they have turned out to be correct. I mean, after all, what Rachel Carson did in 62 simply was to summarize that literature, that is to summarize the published articles and speeches and so on of people before 60, before 1961, and they finally published her book in 1962. So the effects of all this organic chemistry, so to speak, on life has been known for decades, and this is the one of the side effects of all this is that despite the fact that we have the evidence, we keep like blind mice to go on and on and on, and it's just that's what happened.
Thank you, sir. Let me take you back to your youth, sir. When you were a young man in school, what was it that intrigued you about the world of chemistry, the world of that ultimately you began to work in the environmental chemistry and in this arena? What was, describe your early life and how you got interested in these things.
Yeah, I was born on a Greek island, and I went to elementary and high school in this island, Kefalonia. And my father was a small-scale farmer. I mean, he had his own flock of goats and sheep, and he raised his own wheat and lentils. And we had olive trees for oil and vineyards for wine, so we were self-reliant in food. I don't think that my father ever used any of those hard chemicals. And therefore, I mean, the food we ate was the best, and we grew up in harmony, to some degree, harmony with the natural world. And then I got to the United States in 1961, and I went to the University of Illinois, where I studied zoology. And I was planning to go to medical school, but I changed my mind, and I focused on history, getting my master's degree and then PhD in history. And then I did postdoctoral studies in the history of science at Harvard. And all this learning about nature and historical events and so on began to get me to be very, very, very concerned and very interested in industrialized societies that, like the United States, that I was finally living in it. And then my first book that was published in 1976, I look at industrial agriculture and its movement to places like Colombia and India and so on, and I discover, regrettably, that the same model was moved over there, and the so-called rhetoric about the Green Revolution and more food in order to fight hunger was just that. It was rhetoric. And instead, the real purpose was to industrialize those places so they could grow cash crops, so they could sell it back to us, so they could pay back their loans. And it was kind of a cynical discovery that convinced me that something was really wrong. And therefore, with that background and perspective, I joined the agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, in 1979, and I was ready to do my part, so to speak, to join what appeared to be a very noble idea, a very noble institution like the EPA, to protect human health and the environment.
You know, sometime I'd like to have you back and to talk about history, because I'm very much a student of history, and especially not only Greek history, because I've read and enjoyed Plutarch and the Peloponnesian Wars.
Yeah, me too. I love Plutarch too.
I think I've got three translations, an arena that I really, really enjoy. But you mentioned another topic that I find so interesting, the history of science. Because if there's one thing that the history of science shows us, that one of the benefits of science is it's constantly revising its assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Not smoothly, not evenly, not without fits and starts, not without pillaring the occasional new idea and its proponents, but it constantly self-corrects. And I think that's the best thing that can be said about science. It's a constantly self-correcting phenomenon. Okay, so now, like I said, sometime in the future, I'm going to have you back just to talk about history and history of science, but let's continue. Okay, so you came to the EPA. You've begun to realize that industrialized farming, industrialized agriculture or agribusiness has brought this terrible bargain that to accomplish it requires a whole chemistry set that is not without its complications, let's say.
Oh, by the facts, yes. Mm-hmm.
So go ahead. You come to the EPA, and what do you find, sir?
Well, I mean, at EPA, I joined when I got there in 1979. They assigned me to a program. They call it Farm Worker Protection Program. And that really was the eye-opener for me, because I did not know very much about regulation or about the EPA itself, in fact. So I went to a number of seminars while I was at the EPA in the very beginning, and I learned from experts, entomologists, toxicologists, chemists, ecologists. They all were talking about farm workers, and I visited places where farm workers were actually doing their work, and I saw everything. And I got back to Washington, and I wrote a number of memoranda. to my superior, who happened to have been a woman then, and she was a deputy director of the Hazard Evaluation Division. And I explained to her that, you know, what I noticed, what I learned, and what I actually saw in the field is really very, very, very hazardous, very inappropriate for the U.S. government to support a system that actually poisons human beings. And I said to her, I understand we are not in the social welfare business, but at least we could protect these human beings, these farm workers, from being exposed to, let's say, neurotoxins, nerve poisons. And the moment I learned about neurotoxins, I was very offended by this. I said, this is a civilized society. Why would they allow, number one, why would they allow chemical warfare stuff to be used in agriculture? That's my first question, of which no one ever answered. And then in climates like Florida, for instance, or Southern California, or places where it's high temperatures, you don't expect a farm worker to dress like he's going to the moon, so he cannot really be protected from this stuff. And this stuff gets to this person by breathing the air, by touching the leaves of the plant or the tree, and by sometimes eating the already sprayed crop. So I wrote all this memoranda, and I never heard from this deputy director. And I began to talk to my other colleagues. I say, hey, do you have the same experience? How do you justify this? So I talked to ecologists, I talked to biologists, economists, and all of them, they had their own story. And slowly they began to give me their own internal correspondence, that is the memoranda they themselves had written to their superiors about similar events. And it took me 2-3 years probably. Slowly I began to build a library. I said, my God, and I began to review all this literature as a historian.
Right.
I mean, I like to see how things move from one place to the other. And the reaction of one human being with a certain...
You were the perfect person to do that.
Yeah, and eventually, after 20, I was 25 years over there, but within about 10 years or so, I knew for certain I was going to write a book. Because while within the agency, I knew very well I was not exactly effective. They rarely listened to me.
The system wasn't designed to really take truth.
Because I knew that this ideas were extremely sensitive and potentially hazardous to me, I was extremely careful in my writing. I mean, I footnoted everything.
Right.
I spoke to authorities. I read the literature. I cited authorities with quotations and everything else. And that's how I managed to survive. They could never argue against me that I was exaggerating or I was making things up. I never did that. And I was very conservative, in fact. But they still did not listen to me, and so I wrote this book as a way of saying thank you to the American people for giving me a chance to do this, but at the same time warning them this is a system that has to radically change because of the consequences are horrendous both for the natural world and us. And I have a number of in each of my chapters I have a different story that illustrates exactly both the ecological effects and the human health effects.
One of the things that comes across very clearly in your book is that often when called upon by a member of the public or a group of the public to give information that about what the public was viewing as a toxic incident or an instance where health or human reproduction was being threatened, more often than not, the EPA seemed to side with the manufacturers of the chemicals.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this process continues to this very day. And this does not say that the scientists themselves are bad or they don't do a good work. On the contrary, I found my colleagues very well qualified. Most of these people, men and women, they had doctor's degrees in biology, ecology, entomology, medicine, physics, you name it, they all were there. They do their work very well, in fact, very systematically, and they're very careful and, again, conservative in their assessments. But it's the political dimensions of the agency that nullifies all this wonderful scientific work. That is, the president appoints a number of politicians to run the place. They call them assistant administrators, including the administrator himself or herself. And they finally decide on where the science will go, whether to support something or to negate something. And for the most part, it is to support whatever action the industry brings to the attention of the agency. And that is the Achilles heel, so to speak, of the whole system. So in a sense, you can say that all the investments in science and scientists and discussion about science-based decisions and all that is nothing else but extremely sophisticated PR, public relations, or lipstick, in order to confuse the American people about what this agency is all about. It is designed to protect us, human health, and the environment, that is the natural world. That's what the law says. And the mission of the agency is exactly that. But regrettably, because of the political system, has embraced the agency and it has squeezed out all the scientific integrity of the place that it did have in its very beginnings.
You know, one of the points that you make that I think most people would be completely amazed by is you draw attention to the fact that when, quote, pesticides per se are being assessed or being evaluated, there is a component of that pesticide as applied that's been deemed, quote, inert, unquote.
Oh, yes.
And that often this, quote, inert, which seems to imply an inactivity or a harmless nature or a neutral nature, it really can often be as bad, if not worse, than the actual pesticide compound itself.
Yes, indeed. This is part of the law. So they classify a number of chemicals as inert to supposedly say they don't cause any harm, but unfortunately, as I document in the book, most of those inerts are toxic, in fact, sometimes more toxic than the so-called active ingredient. So, for instance, you have petroleum distillates. They are, by definition, carcinogens, that is, they cause cancer. And yet the industrialist, the manufacturer of pesticide, can take those those chemicals, the petroleum distillates, and put them with the active ingredient and create a chemical that's supposed to be, and then the farmers use it. So what it also means is that the farmer never uses the stuff, the chemical, for which he thinks he's using. Let's call the chemical X. He thinks he buys that X to spray for insects, and unfortunately that X is mixed up with A, B, C, D, E. And the total number of those chemicals, when they're sprayed in the field, not only they potentiate the impact, that is, they become even more toxic, but the person who tries to find out what caused the damage, it's very difficult to do that because this person does not know what he's looking for. The mixture changes the nature of the original chemical, so we have this really kind of a medieval chemical mixture that we dump into the environment, and we call it whatever name we give it. So when I talk and I find environmental lawyers, I said, this is the case for you, environmental lawyers, sue the agency, sue the chemical industry for this misleading and, that's right, for this misleading statement and practice, because we really don't, we are not supposed to use these extra chemicals to do whatever we want to do. We only have approval by, and the law says, you know, the chemical has to be registered by EPA and so on. So there's a special name, and that's the name we think we are using, but regrettably we use that plus a number of other chemicals which are extremely dangerous, and they potentiate the act and they cause much more damage to human beings or the environment.
Now, I noticed that in your discussion of these, that these petroleum distillates are often in and of themselves carcinogens. They actually cause, they're known cancer causers.
Exactly. But sometimes we discover that some of the so-called inerts, they would take, for instance, DDT. DDT was banned by EPA in 1972. They would take that banned chemical and mix it up with other chemicals, and they would define that as inert. So you can see, therefore, the fraud perpetuated on the public and on the farmers in particular, because the farmers don't really know what's going on. They simply spray the stuff that they think the chemical, the industry with the government have approved, and they read the labels on the can, and they say, well, if we follow the labels, we'll be okay. Well, that's not true at all because of this mixture, this stuff that we call inerts. Therefore, if they were to reorganize, they ought to get rid of all the stuff that they call inerts. And in fact, they should begin to test the inerts separately and then put and also test them together, because together there is this impact, or the molecules move with each other and they form new compounds, and therefore the toxicity increases tremendously.
You know, that brings to mind another issue, and I want to mention our good friends at the Farm Worker Association here in Florida, and Jeannie Economos in particular,
yeah,
who are on the front lines. As you said, what happens in the field is so different than what we might say is the ideal application, and especially when you're in a hot environment like Florida or Texas or California, and you've got people in the field, many of whom may not even be literate. How are they going to read a set of instructions? You know, what are they wearing as they go out in the field? Often they're shirtless, I would imagine. You know, as you said, you can't have these people wearing a moon suit in 90-degree weather. That's just not going to happen. It's not realistic.
Yeah, I mean, even the EPA, in the very beginning, they had funded studies to find out more about farm workers and what happens to them. And they discovered, this is a case study which I cite in the book, there were two brothers, two black brothers from Florida, by the way, and they managed to get money from the National Science Foundation and EPA. And this took place in the late 70s. So they followed the migrant farm workers and through a number of states, and they finally wrote a report. And their main conclusion was, number one, that these farm workers lose about 25 years of their lives. That is, a 25-year-old man who does this work has the medical symptoms of a 50-year-old man, something like that. And, of course, they did not talk about cancer, because cancer takes a long time. But they did warn the EPA that this is completely inappropriate. They spoke about their hunger, about their tirelessness, their sleeplessness, their anger because of the work they do and the exposure of the chemicals. They have very little sanitation facilities when they stop for one evening or two evenings in a place. In other words, they, like Jeannie Economos mentioned, and she spoke so straightforwardly, they are like slaves, the kind of slaves we imagine in the Roman times, and then during the Industrial Revolution, and of course the slaves that this country used to have up to very, very recently, up maybe late 18th century. And so it's just completely inappropriate that we take these people, or they are forced to do this kind of work, and we expose them to this very danger, which is real. They are like the guinea, the canaries in the
coal
mine.
Yeah.
You know, they get the diseases and they get the problems that we are going to get eventually later if we continue to eat food that has been treated or contaminated by these substances. So the whole farm worker system is completely inappropriate. I would simply demolish it. I would say no. I would say to the farmers, you want farm workers? Sure, okay. Cut up your property to pieces that are designed that you and your family can do most of the work. And if you were to hire somebody, you have to pay that person very well and protect him very well. And don't use this stuff when you have human beings working in the field. I mean, that's just... So there's a tremendous amount of work that has to be done. We have to rethink about the nature of the whole industrial agricultural system. Is it appropriate to allow a person to have 5,000 acres of land, 20,000 acres of land, and grow just one crop? And then allow that person to use a helicopter to spray all these toxins, which, if it rains, will end up going into a river or a creek and it will kill everything? Is it appropriate, after all this history of 70 years of spraying all the synthetic chemicals and the kind of ecological effects we have had, the disappearance of most of our birds, the extinction rate is tremendous as we speak right now, the cancer rate is tremendous as we speak right now, after all, in EPA itself, in the early 80s, had evidence that farmers in Iowa were dying from cancer at twice the rate for the rest of the country, or rather people that live in the cities. Imagine the rate of farm death and farm worker death today if somebody could actually study the situation. But unfortunately, most of the researchers and the governors stay away from that. They don't study the problem, so we assume everything is perfectly okay. It's not perfectly okay at all.
You know, you bring another point up in that particular discussion that I think is really critical. Many people who were concerned about the, if you will, industrial chemistry in urban environments, from the pesticides, from the smog, from the smoke, moved out into the country. The growth of suburbia attests the fact that people get out of urban spaces when they can afford it to move to more suburban or even rural communities. Mm-hmm. And yet we hear stories constantly. You mentioned a story early in your book about families in the Five Rivers area of Oregon who were living in forests and finding spray on the forest was impacting their reproductive health. Could you talk about that, sir?
Yes, the Forest Service and the timber companies in Oregon, they continue to. In fact, right now it's only the private companies that continue to spray herbicides, that is weed killers, over their forest. And there are men, women, families living maybe 5, maybe 6, maybe 2 miles away from the sprayed area, and the wind moves all that spray on them. So the spray sprays the people directly, plus it contaminates their drinking water, and we have had this horrendous epidemic of cancer. But in the case of the Five Rivers area in Oregon, they used to spray then 2,4,5-T. And 2,4,5-T is one of the two components, the other being 2,4-D, that constitutes the so-called Agent Orange, which was used during the war in Vietnam. In other words, the U.S. Air Force sprayed, I don't know how many gallons, but probably hundreds of thousands of gallons of this stuff over the forests of Vietnam, and they would kill the trees and vegetation in order to detect where the enemy was hiding, that sort of thing. But in the process, not only they were killing the vegetation and, you know, causing an ecological tremendous effect on nature, but that chemical had been contaminated with an extremely toxic chemical known as dioxin. Now, in the case of Oregon, the women complained to the EPA with a letter to the administrator that we cannot really deliver the babies that we are pregnant with. So the EPA then knew something about it, so they sent their investigators and they detected this dreadful molecule, the 2,4,5-T. The dioxin molecule, they detected in a creek very close to the women's homes. And because of that discovery, they immediately began proceedings against 2,4,5-T, which they finally got rid of it in 1983 after detailed discussions with Dow Chemical and the understanding that they would never touch 2,4-D, which is still in the market. Now, the dioxin is, nobody creates dioxin. The dioxin is a product of industrial processes. It's a contaminant. But if you create 2,4,5-T, you're going to get the contaminant, the dioxin contaminant. So this is what happened. And now for the today's products have dioxin, I cannot speak of because I don't know. But considering that the processes of creation remain pretty much the same, you never know. So that's the story of dioxin. And dioxin, of course, was found in other parts of the country. And the EPA intervened and they began to change and clean up the system. But this dioxin stuff, you know, causes problems and cancer in the parts per trillion. Now, to understand what we're talking about, if you take one postage stamp and put it over the city of Dallas, Texas, you are talking about one part per trillion. They are almost infinitesimal in size, very tiny. You cannot see it. And yet it has tremendous ecological toxic effects, so to speak. And this is the story, and that's how we got rid of the 2,4,5-T. And the women in Oregon actually performed a public service by bringing this to the attention of EPA, and EPA then having the courage to do what it did.
My wife and I took our family and moved to a rural area of Miami just outside the national park. Mm-hmm. And like many rural areas, it has a large agricultural area there as well. Well, one morning, my children were playing outside, and I heard a plane overhead. Actually, excuse me, it was the afternoon. And the kid said, hey, the plane is spraying us. And what happened? And it turned out that I had heard from neighbors that this was a common practice, that the local agricultural sprayer would, on his way back to his airstrip, he would dump the remaining pesticide and herbicide that he had in his plane to show that, quote, he sprayed it all, but he would dump it wherever he felt like. And I was horrified, ordered the kids out of the yard, came out, and there was so much of this stuff all over the ground. It was literally like mud splashes all over my car. I wiped up this green-blue mud-like stuff, took a sample of it down to our Department of Environmental Protection, so to speak, and they said, oh, this happens all the time. Don't worry about it. I said, excuse me. You know what? I am concerned. I want to know what exactly it is. He goes, oh, well, that's a herbicide that they use all the time. And in fact, if you want, he said, we'll write him a strongly worded letter. I said, excuse me, how is dumping agricultural chemicals on a residential area a matter for a strongly worded letter? He goes, oh, no, we write those all the time. I said, wait a minute, has this particular guy, I told him where the plane landed, I said, has this guy gotten your, quote, strongly worded letters before? He goes, oh, yeah, we've sent half a dozen to him. He does it all the time. Mm-hmm. I said, at what point does some responsibility kick in where you're going to actually stop the guy from this kind of behavior? And he goes, oh, well, we don't really have the power to do that. But we can write a strongly worded letter. I will if you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the kind of irresponsible behavior on the part of public officials. The common understanding is that we're going to allow this to go on. I mean, the case in Oregon is extreme.
Right.
I went to Oregon last year because of my book, and I spoke to people in seven different towns. They're all these little rural towns, very closely related to the big forest that the timber company spray. And I heard the discussion about people dying of cancer. Indeed, the woman who invited me for that book tour, she just died. She died last week of cancer. And I wrote an article about her, Audrey Moore. The anger of the people of Oregon is absolutely at its height. Indeed, they are so upset by what is happening, what has been happening for decades, by the way, not a couple of days, is that they are bringing lawyers from Pennsylvania who specialize in writing provisions for voters to vote in order to forbid the spraying of these chemicals in their communities. Of course, the state of Oregon, like the state of Florida probably, they say, look, we are preeminent, so you community, you have no right to pass a law that will contradict the law that we already have passed. So, but we need to do what they do in Oregon in order to demonstrate to the politicians of the state that time has come to begin to rethink about the whole system of legal system that allows this kind of aggressive behavior to go on. It's a kind of a chemical warfare going on in a very small scale, of course. They don't send airplanes over the cities and say, we're going to try to kill you. But in a sense, because of what they do with the massive industrial agriculture, it turns out to be like that. And people die of cancer, and they don't know why they die of cancer. My friend, when she moved to Oregon, she came out of California. She went there for retirement, so they bought a beautiful house in the forest. I visited her. I stayed with her for 3 days with her husband. And they have a gorgeous little place, 6 acres of land. It looks gorgeous. It's a nice creek next to the house. But she said to me, unfortunately, what you see is deceptive. They spray us, and our water probably is contaminated. And the woman just died last week. So this is the kind of behavior that we need to change. And to change that, we need to know what is going on. And then we need to take our public officials directly. They are as equally responsible as the companies about what's going on. Indeed, I would argue they are probably more responsible because the companies would not be doing that unless they got permitted by the local authorities, the state authorities in this case. So this is the new kind of political involvement that Americans have to begin to practice. They have to see reality as is rather than what they get on television and act accordingly. What happened to you is completely criminal activity, to spray very hazardous chemicals over you or your children. That is unacceptable or ought to be unacceptable behavior in a democracy.
And, you know, to further your point, something that came up during the conference was that, and this is true in a nuclear sense as well, exposure of women and children has far more impact than the exposure of grown humans and men, because children are in those formative years where the cell replication, where the growth period is going on, and it has a far greater effect on small humans than it does on grown-ups. I was going to ask you if you have time to tell one more story. You talk about coming upon a treasure trove of documents about the you came across a stack of papers that was about to be thrown out, that was being a report, and the supervisor said, listen, make sure you destroy those because I don't want those documents coming back from the grave.
Exactly.
About the Texas contamination.
This was, I think, during the Reagan administration. During the Reagan administration, the whole idea was to pretty much almost shut down the EPA. Despite the fact that the EPA has always served the interests of the industry, the Republicans felt even that was not sufficient. They needed zero regulation, as they continue to speak to this very day. So the EPA scientists, the staff, are extremely intelligent. They read these Republicans or Democrats very clearly, and they know what is in the air. So they smell the air and they act accordingly. So they knew that if they had letters, evidence, or studies that demonstrated what we have been talking about, that is the connection between spraying a cancer or spraying a neurological disease and so on, that would be bad for them. So they began to shred the documents or dump them, like in this case. And it was just some day in the evening, in the afternoon, I saw all this. My gosh, I said, what is going on? So I looked down and I immediately began to detect the correspondence in the scientific division that I used to work. So I said, well, I need to take a look at them and read them. So I used to collect documents.
Oh, you historian, you.
Yeah, so I got two boxes of them, and I ran them, put them in my office, and the person that ran the branch, he saw me, the branch division. He said to me, Vagelos or Evan, they used to call me Evan, you better just disappear this. Get these documents, get rid of them. We don't want them to come up from the grave or something to that effect. And I assure him, yeah, don't worry, no problem. And, of course, I use them in the writing of my book. I mean, this is the kind of illegal activity that is taking place because not because anybody is ordering them to do that, but because they know what is expected of them.
Right.
Indeed, during the Reagan administration, the very vice president used to be the old Bush, George Bush Sr.
Right.
His faction was to be in head of what they called then regulatory relief, meaning
right.
He would go to every government agency and try to tell them to tone down or to abolish or to restrict or to do nothing about what the law says they had to do. This is the sort of thing that is still going on, unfortunately. And so I worry. I mean, the Republicans and the Democrats have pretty much the same position in all this, but the Republicans are more forceful, and they threaten the staff, they cut the budget more dramatically, and they outright, they you know who their friends are. But the Democrats are more diplomatic. They say, no problem, go ahead and do your work, and we're going to do science-based research and so on. Meanwhile, their political men are cutting down all these deals behind the curtain, so to speak, and they keep doing the same sort of thing. This is why in any reorganization of EPA, we have to cut down all these political appointees so we can give the chance for this agency to become politically dependent of the White House, independent of Congress, and independent of the chemical industry, of course. The industrial polluters that come there and they lobby the agency every day of the year. And to me, that's extreme. I used to argue with my colleagues, why don't we also invite environmentalists to follow up and to participate in the meetings we have with these polluters?
Probably wasn't welcome, was it?
You're dreaming.
I wanted to share one more story with you and get your reaction. I was producing a television show on a local TV station, and it was about fishing. You know, Florida has a great recreational fishing industry, and
yes.
They were promoting, fishing guides and fishing tours, and, you know, from freshwater fishing to saltwater fishing, and, of course, the famous game fishing we have on the coast here. And it just so happened at that same time that with the terrible pollution that's being released from Lake Okeechobee, both to the east and to the west, there's been terrible algae blooms, and often the water gets so toxic that our underworked regulators, who rarely find anything they need to regulate, it got so bad they had to come out and say, look, don't touch the water. Not even don't get in, but don't touch the water.
That's right.
It's so toxic, right? And I'm, you know, part of my brain is hearing this, and then part of my work, what I did for a living was to produce this fishing show. So I pulled my two hosts aside one day after the show, and I said, let me ask you a question. You know, have you guys heard in the news that the county has warned people to not touch the water?
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, yeah, we heard that. But now, you know, we got to go. We've got some fishing tours. We're going to go take people to go fishing. And I said, wait a minute. The fishing spots you're promoting is in the river that has been deemed so toxic that you're not supposed to touch it. And I said, yeah, what's the problem? And I said, they said, don't worry, we're not going to touch it. We're just going to fish. And I said, you know, the fish live in the water. I mean, clearly I've got to draw these guys a picture. He said, the fish are in the water. And you're urging people to fish and then eat these fish. They said, yeah, and? I said, you know, obviously you haven't made a connection that if fish are living in toxic water and you're eating the fish, you are getting a dose of this toxic water. And they said, oh, no, you know, listen, we don't want to talk about that. That's not an issue. We're here to promote fishing. And I said, look, I understand what you're here to do. I have a civic responsibility, I believe. And it just so happened we had some game officers, some Florida state officials who were in the game fishing and game hunting, who happened to be on the show that day. And I pulled one of them aside. And I said, let me ask you a question, sir. Can you give me the name of your senior water chemist for the Florida Fish and Wildlife? And the guy looks at me and rolls his eyes. And he said, oh, you'll never get him to talk. I said, look, that's my problem. You just give me his name and phone number and I'll get him. He said, no, they don't let that guy out. He doesn't talk to the public. And I said, I can understand why. So I tracked the fellow down, and I get him to agree to a phone interview. He wouldn't agree to a televised interview, but he would do a phone interview. So I put his picture up, as we tend to do in the media. And I ask him some questions. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, typically, Floridians who are aware – now, obviously, I'm not talking about the guy who's got a fishing pole in the canal but Floridians who are aware are typically aware that the most dangerous fish to eat are those in freshwater – and they tend to think that the saltwater fish are more safe. I said, I wanted to get your opinion as a water chemist working for Fish and Wildlife. What's your assessment of the safety of fish taken in Florida waters? He said, oh, I would never touch them. No way. Not fresh, not salt. And I said, really? That's interesting. He goes, oh, but listen, you know, we don't talk about that. And I said, well, I understand. There's a vested in, you know, economic interest in promoting Florida fishing.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't it be better if instead of just stopping any words that we actually did something about cleaning it up so that then we could honestly say, hey, eat some Florida fish. He said, well, I'll tell you what, there is one fish you can eat. It's safe. He said, for some reason, the fish called dolphin or mahi-mahi, for some reason, that fish doesn't accumulate mercury. But all the other fish that are known, you know, the snapper, the grouper, and all that, he said, these are predatory fish. And, of course, as predators, at the top of the food chain, they're bioaccumulators.
Yes, indeed.
And I said, so that's your assessment. He goes, oh, yeah, I tell people not to eat anything.
Well, remember in our discussion last week in Florida, you know, we had Professor Tyrone Hayes from Berkeley, California, Berkeley, and he spoke about the frogs.
Right.
Remember, he said a tiny amount of this herbicide called atrazine castrates the frogs.
Right.
And he said the people, meaning the farmers who use atrazine, they have the equivalent of about 22,000 more atrazine in their body than the amount required to castrate a frog.
Right.
So what do you think about the farmers then?
Sure.
But do the farmers themselves know that? I doubt it very much.
Right.
So it's not just coming from me, but it's coming out of working scientists like Tyrone Hayes today. And the other fellow, Louis Gillette, he's at the University of Florida, and now he's in Southern Carolina. Same thing about the alligators. You have castrated alligators in Lake Apopka in Florida.
Right.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, what more ecological evidence do you need to actually take action?
Well, see, sir, we have a solution to that in Florida. We're not allowed to use the word climate change.
Well, that's obscene. In my humble opinion, that is completely outrageous.
Well,
that's
sir,
true. I mean, that is obscene.
That is right from the government. Sir, thank you so very much for spending some time with us today. And please, you have to agree, I will call you up and get you to come back on and talk about the history of science.
Yeah,
another time, I want to have you come back and talk about Greek history. It is the founder of what we laughingly call Western civilization. So thank you, sir, so very much for your time.
And my pleasure.
That book of yours, Poison Spring, should be on every person's reading list. It's absolutely fantastic. It's well written. Thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for the work that you do, sir.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.